Greetings, dear listeners. Before we get started, a reminder to head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and consider becoming a paying subscriber if you're not one yet. You'll get access to, among other things, the full conversation, as well as other subscriber-only benefits. And don't forget to give us a like and review on your favorite podcast app. With all that out of the way, on to the show. Anyway, what I was saying about recording in a studio is that it's better and it's easier to talk when you're like face to face with someone. It's easier to like take cues than staring at a goddamn screen.
Absolutely. We're all tired of Zoom.
Exactly.
Still.
And recording generally, Wisdom of Crowds, you know, it's funny. Like during COVID, we were doing it more in person. And then after COVID, we're doing it more remote now. But it's the downside is it still takes a while for me to set up my studio in my living room because, you know, I'm not an animal. I don't like keep a studio like going in my one bedroom all the time because that would be weird.
I don't think an animal would do that. No, I think that's a very human weirdness.
Yeah. Okay. Not like a weirdo, an incel. But it's nevertheless, so it's, I mean, I don't mind setting it up. It's fun. But then I'm tired. I don't know what the hell we're going to talk about. I've like spent all this energy setting it all up and it's like, ugh, here we are.
Yeah, well, we can talk about the whooshing noise of air that maybe we're both like phantom hearing.
Yeah, possible.
Yeah. No, what else happened? What else happened today?
Eclipses happened.
There was the eclipse. Yeah, there was we were not in, DC is not in the path of totality. It was only 87% totality, but it still felt pretty cool. I mean, I went outside. Well, first I accidentally stared into the sun because I thought it was getting dark outside and was worried about cloud cover and then went to look and see what the clouds were doing. I was like, oh, nope, that's the sun.
Do you think that like, I was talking to some colleagues about this. I sometimes feel that the whole thing about, what's it called? The warnings they give people before the eclipses.
Yeah.
It's so overblown because they just don't want, they're worried about lemmings, you know, just staring at the sun and burning their retina out. So they overwarn in order to like, to make it okay. Because the reality is that, you know, it's not like we've all like glanced at the sun a little bit. I think if like, if you're like squinting.
So it's different. So this is actually the thing. Too bad we aren't publishing this before the eclipse when this would have been helpful information for people. But it's actually a different experience of looking at the sun looks different during an eclipse. So apparently, so I am not going to get the science of this right exactly. But from what I understand, like normally when you go outside, you're like, whatever, outside, your eyes are already like kind of minutely adjusting to the light levels. Mm. And so even if you don't feel like you're squinting, your like retinas, whatever, have adjusted such that you're not getting like the full amount of the sun's light. But during an eclipse, because it's like kind of weirdly dark, like the light setup is different, your eyes don't adjust as quickly. And so they're like fully open.
Yeah, dilated pupils, and then you burn your retina out.
And then the sun is like super extra bright in a way that it isn't on a normal day. Like, yeah, I mean, okay. This is going to sound dumb. I stare at the sun all the time.
No, fair enough. Okay, I'll grant you that one. But here's the one, and I was talking to colleagues about less about lemmings staring at the sun, but more about the other one. The other warning that was going around was like, the sun will burn your sensor of your phone. How many freaking like Instagram photos of people with sunsets taking videos of sunsets are there? That's like your sensor's constantly open to the phone.
No, but again, it's like the different light setup. Like I don't know exactly how to explain this. I read many articles about this, but it is a different thing. I took a photo using my phone, but I put little eclipse glasses over my phone. But I will say, you know, the second where I stupidly like looked out the window to see what was going on and saw the sun, it was bright. Like I got a little bit worried because I had like a very visible,
like eclipse,
yeah. No, like just like the
burnt into
a stamp.
What is it called? After
an after image, yeah. After, in a way that like I don't get from the normal sun, and this was for like a split second that I was looking at it. And then I like went outside and got some glasses from my neighbor and joined sort of the crowd of lemmings who were outside using sun protection. But it was also kind of nice. It was like a mass event in the way a harmless mass event also. In a form that we don't have very often anymore. Like there's the mass event of like, oh no, everyone's like taking over the Capitol and that's sad.
Right.
But this is like the sun.
Right.
Science. Right. We love science.
So there was dudes in MAGA hats and you and like, everyone was just like.
I was wearing the hat with the horns on it. We were like beating our chests.
And you're just like looking. No. I'm saying you as an urbane liberal next to your MAGA neighbors, and everyone's together, we're all Americans looking at the eclipse. That's what I'm saying. Kumbaya.
all Americans staring at the sun.
Staring at the sun like a bunch of lemmings, right?
It was a beautiful time. And you can't mock Demir. I saw that you took a picture.
I did.
How did you do that without burning your camera?
I had my nice camera and I did like a bunch of reading. And honestly, what I was saying about the sensor thing really freaked me out. I was like, you know, okay, I burn my iPhone, I take it back to the Apple store and make up some story, Apple Care, fix my camera, you know, whatever. But it's a camera, you know, like, and I like my camera, I use it a lot. And I was like, God, this is so crazy. So I put like what's called a neutral density filter, which is sort of like sunglasses for your lens. Cute. I put that on. But I'm still reading and they're like, that's not enough. You need crazy solar filters and shit. I was like, Jesus. So whatever, like I just fiddled with the settings. And what it was, I mean, I guess it matches to what you're saying. I just turned down the sensitivity of the sensor, which I guess is, and I made the pupil of the lens, you know, the iris, as small as possible, the aperture. You know this stuff.
Cameras.
I don't know if our listeners know this stuff, but anyway, the aperture, i.e. the pupil of the lens, I made that as small as possible, turned down the sensitivity of the sensor. And then like made sure that the shutter was just like super quick and it completely blacked out the sky. And all you can see is the sun and the moon like going through it.
It's a very cool picture. We should use that as the picture for the podcast.
All right. Yeah, we can do that. So anyway, America, togetherness. We sat down to record this and like the topic was going to be broadly, the Monday note I wrote, and I literally finished writing it maybe about an hour before we sat down to record just now. And I guess what's on my mind, we can like build on this sort of America and community stuff. I mean, we can roam in the Monday note and hit on different things. It's about, this book by this Albanian author, Lea Ipi. And her book is a memoir about growing up in communist societies and then sort of the transition that comes after that. What I really liked about that book, and I didn't really get into it in the Monday notes so much, was this kind of feeling of commonality. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, you and our listeners like may not appreciate the extent to which Albania is completely different from all the other South Slavic lands and countries. Like Albanian language is like Finnish. You know what I mean? It's not related to Finnish, but it's as different from other European languages as the Finnish language is from all others. It is just, you know, you get there and you might as well be reading Sanskrit or Chinese or something. It is so completely opaque. And you know, you can learn a few words, but you can't understand anything. And given that Albania had a particularly severe regime, you know, you don't even have that sort of like dual language signs. I mean, they're coming back now. They are putting them up now. But, you know, it's the country was so isolated itself that not that many people speak English. So even that, the next generation, it's getting better. But what's interesting about her book was that it really, even still, And even still, the fact that like I didn't really grow up in communism at all, unlike her and unlike a lot of people, you know, that have basically.
Yeah.
There's still something about a shared, I don't know how to put it. Is it a shared historical memory, a shared historical experience, and a kind of, I don't know. I guess it's culture is the best way to put it. Even though Albanian culture is so different, and there's some kind of shared culture, not just in, you know, Southeast Europe, like the Balkans and, you know, Bulgaria, Romania, whatever. But I think it in many ways going up all the post-Soviet countries, there's a kind of shared experience of some sort that doesn't map perfectly on country to country, but is. I don't know. It's there. And you know, it really struck me reading this book. I wrote an essay for Wisdom of Crowds a while ago when I was just sort of hanging out in North Macedonia, and like I ended up connecting with a bunch of people from former Yugoslavia, and it was again
As one does.
As one does back then in one's life. And that hit me again. It was this sort of weird feeling of, it's not community, but it's some kind of shared experience.
Yeah, I was going to say it doesn't. Yeah, it sounds. I mean, you first described Albania as being very strange, and then it sounds like it's not a shared culture,
right?
But yeah, but a shared experience of something that happened, perhaps like living through the fall of communism, and like this, a very, I imagine, specific and strange experience of flipping from one belief system, regime, understanding of the world to a totally different one very fast. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. And, but you know what I mean? Like the weird part is that I didn't really live through that. I was here. That's the weird part. I mean, and Yugoslavia was this, you know, probably the least extreme of all those countries. And so though our collapse from communism, actually we went straight to war, unlike Albania, which had 7 years of sort of liberalism, and then all the other countries, Velvet Divorce and Czechoslovakia and all the others, where, you know, war didn't come. They just had sort of a rough patch getting into, like, you know, liberal Western Europe. And yet still there's something there. There's something there. And, you know, I don't want to say that it's like a, it's overstating it to say that it's shared trauma. Because it's not trauma, but it's something like that. It's something like that that has to do with, I think, disillusionment.
Yeah. So first of all, just for everyone listening to the pod, Demir is using a therapy word, trauma.
Yeah.
And he's believing it. Mm. But so actually some clarifying questions there. You say that you were here, but you must have kind of inherited this understanding somehow, or this feeling. Like, where were your parents? And like, did you have family who experienced it firsthand and then transmitted their traumatic experience, or even just their understanding to you? Because I feel like that's definitely, that could be a thing. Like, even if you didn't fully experience the event, but you're surrounded by people or spend time with people or brought up by people who did, then like their habits of mind naturally shape yours as well.
Yeah. You know, again, so my parents, well, I mean, we lived abroad all the time. And we didn't live in Yugoslavia at all. You know, they did when they were a lot younger. But my mom, you know, shortly after university went, to pursue architecture. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, in Switzerland. And my father got his degree in Glasgow in economics. And also, you know, first I think worked a little bit in Yugoslavia with his like economics degree, but then shortly thereafter went abroad and worked for the UNDP. Mm-hmm. And then so when they got married, he was already working abroad. And I think he was already based in Karachi in Pakistan, and my mom like followed him out there. So they were abroad the whole time. There was going back all the time to see extended family. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't, you know, and maybe it's just sort of my lack of, maybe still to this day, understanding of how Yugoslavia worked. Kind of like in those that read the Monday Note, you'll see some of the things that I draw out of Lea Ipi's book about her growing up in communist Yugoslavia, communist Albania, much stricter regime. Her family is on some shit list, you know, they're basically lying to her about everything that's going on, mm-hmm. speaking in code. I mean, that just didn't happen in Yugoslavia. Certainly not, you know, I was born in 76, not like late Yugoslavia like that. It was a much more mellow place at that point. There were repressions earlier. And my folks, you know, didn't join the party. So it's different. And so, you know, I don't think like even my family had a particularly prototypical, you know, communist growing up experience. It's just that there's this kind of, well, I don't know. Maybe it's what you were saying earlier, just like a kind of shared going through a period of change where your compass just gets rattled. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. You don't even have to necessarily be like, on the ground, I think, to experience that, even if you are outside of the country and your frame of reference for looking at the country is one thing, and then you know, turn your back on it for a second, then you look back and the whole place is like totally different. That still shocking, and still like you would have to find a way to, or not, I guess, but deal with that. And that, yeah, that's a very specific experience, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, I wonder how much of that is, fine, ding me for shrink talk, but the you know, in the sense that that kind of big change, you know, I think it's something that is lost on people, maybe because, you know, the Soviet Union was so clearly barbarous towards the end, even though it too had, you know, mellowed a lot from Stalin's purges and the rest of it. And, you know, all the repressions of East Germany, and all the sort of, you know, Romania, you know, not to speak of all the that kind of nastiness. Nevertheless, there was a kind of, I don't know what, there's an idealism to that world communist idea that, quite frankly, I think I see it in you and people younger than you that are still somehow like reaching for this. But that really does get erased completely in 89, 90. And I think that
the nostalgia or the desire or just that moment,
the optimism, at least a kind of lingering optimism that you could build that kind of better world, mm-hmm. a better world, that on some level, you know, I think to just push it back, it's, there's a conception of what human beings are and that like probably in some state of nature that they're probably more good than bad. Right.
Uh-huh.
And so that like, there's like, more space for emergent cooperation, and greed is not a part of it. And, you know, if only you arrange things the right way that the evils in society don't dominate good mankind, you know, you can have a more humane system, a system that is not beset by all the nastiness of market competition, right? Mm-hmm. Now, again, like I'm oversimplifying a bit because, right, the Europeans have social democracy. That's how they fought communism, by coming up with like a softer version of it, et cetera, et cetera. But still, you know, I think in 89, 90, that kind of ideal completely goes away. And like Frank Fukuyama's End of History is something like profound in the fact that it says like, these things have been disproven. You have no alternative. The alternative is exploiting competition and human beings' greed and proclivity to compete with each other, if not murder each other, to tame that. And guess what? Through the invisible hand, you know, prosperity arises. And we know that's the case because all the societies that tried something different fell apart.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I mean, in some ways, the picture that you paint is very beautiful, and one can see how one would be attracted to it. And yeah, I think what you're saying about there still being almost a nostalgia for that is just like very clearly in evidence. I mean, if you read like a lot of the literature, that's not quite right, but there's so much reporting now about how in, you know, Russia today and in post-communist countries today, like especially older people kind of are sort of like, Stalin, we knew what we had. Yeah. Like that, it wasn't that bad, which is, I don't know. Is it a longing for stability, a longing for like having that ideal, even though you sort of know intellectually it didn't necessarily work out the way that you were told, but having a beautiful dream in mind is just nice. It's different. And so the question that I had actually for this is, did the dream have to be disproven, I guess? I mean,
wait, what do you mean have to be, or was it?
Well, so after the fall of communism, there was the introduction of, you know, free market liberalism, of capitalism. And as you say, the what was stated was kind of like, your plans failed. It just failed, and this is better.
Yeah.
Did that have to be the introduction? The wholesale replacement, and not just the replacement, but also the denigration of the idea that came before? That could never have worked. It never will work. As opposed to like, it didn't work this time. Let's try something different. Well, maybe this is... Is this naive?
I mean, naive.
Is there nothing joyful in ISIS?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's not, it's naive. It's neglecting the, you know, the reality of it is that, again, East Germany was shooting people that tried to get away. And East Germans figured out pretty easily how much better life was on the other side, and you weren't getting shot. So there was like two things, just focusing on the two Germanies for a second. There's real murderous repression and poverty on the one side, and what looks like freedom and prosperity on the other side.
And genes. Yeah.
And genes. But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
just
no,
basically in the sense of you're raising a family and you want what's over there. You don't want what's over here. You see this actually, you know, pretty clearly in Lea Ipi's book as well, you know, in the sense that the parents clearly are just like biting their tongue, even as their daughter is getting raised within the, you know, the doctrinaire communist.
Really drinking the Kool-Aid.
Drinking the Kool-Aid, but it's they are doing it for her benefit because the system may not fall apart and they want the best for her possible. But as soon as it goes, they're like off to the races, you know, communist bastards, all the rest of it, because, and it's just understandable. Do you know what I mean? What's interesting about...
Wait, is it understandable because also her family was specifically oppressed and targeted by the regime? Or just if you think it was reasonable just as a reaction to deprivation that they as adults saw that she didn't recognize?
I mean, it's probably both, I would say. Certainly being on the outs with the regime because, you know, descended from
right
like bad family. Is part of it, but you know what I mean? It's the other part of it is that none of the communist countries, for all of their stated ideals, practiced anything approaching that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had a very well established and privileged top class of, you know, bureaucrats and party officials and the rest of that. And, you know, what was that old joke, like towards the end of communism, right? It's like, we pretend to work, they pretend to pay us. And then whatever inequalities like those that existed, maybe the edges were softened because, you know, productivity was low. Everyone was poor, but no one was starving. You know what I mean? And as long as you didn't have an oppressive police state governing your thinking, which in the more oppressive places there was, it was at least tolerable. But in those places where it, you know, I think there was repression, and then there was this, you could look over there and it looked so much better. I think it was just totally normal to immediately, when it flipped, to embrace the other and completely abandon this. You know, you're talking about nostalgia. The you see it in weird places in former Yugoslavia. I don't think you see it in Slovenia, for example. Which
why
is,
not?
Because they're in the EU and they got out quick. You know, the war barely touched them. And it's been generally a prosperous and not that bumpy ride. You don't see it in Croatia because we had a particularly bloody ride getting out of it. And, you know, I think the association there is sort of like national ethnic strife is equated with the sort of Yugoslav project, where Croats in particular saw themselves as being under the boot of Serbs, who were trying to create hegemony for, you know, the Serbian people in there. Where you do see it is in Bosnia, is like Yugo nostalgia. You see it in to a certain extent, I think, in parts of Serbia still. I was surprised you see it in parts of North Macedonia as well. You don't see it in Kosovo because the Kosovars were under the Serbian boot the whole time there, and like rights deprived from them. So, you know, there are certainly people that feel that they've lost something that, you know, wouldn't have wanted to, you know, go through the war. So, you know, there's war and sorrow and war. Thank God we got through that and we have our state. Those are the sort of like two things. So yeah, I think you'll get that kind of nostalgia, but it's unique, or maybe at least partially unique, or maybe not all that unique, just because Yugoslavia's communism was so soft and we could travel. We were not restricted. I mean, like I was saying about my family, my mom, you know, went to Switzerland. My dad studied in Scotland. There were no restrictions on Yugoslavs traveling. Not a big deal.
Well, so yeah, so I think that is probably very key, but I'm also interested in the sort of solidarity that might have been engendered by solidarity is a very positive word, and it feels weird to be using it so positively about like ostensibly a very negative regime or way of government, but the ideals of communism, idea that humans, as you describe, are like basically good, that we all want to like achieve this higher goal, which maybe it failed, but just that affect almost stands in direct contrast to the affect of, you know, Milton Friedman and liberalism, which is that humans are greedy and kind of terrible. And if you let the market sort it out, the market is moved by human greed and will eventually sort things out. But, and that's, I guess, them being eventually sorted out is nice, but the underlying understanding is just everyone is selfish and out for themselves. And that's just the baseline. That's a very different kind of moral baseline and understanding of the human person that seems less intrinsically joyous. I don't know. But like, I can see why that is not embraced with the sort of like heartfelt love that communism, however much it failed, might have been, just because of the level of optimism, something that was there. And I also need to say I'm being very like internet poisoned right now, and I'm using the word joyous because there's that Joyce Carol Oates tweet that rings in my head where she was like, all we hear of ISIS is puritanical and punitive. Is there nothing celebratory and joyous?
Good Lord.
Or is Query naive?
Good Lord. I missed that.
Yeah, Query is naive, Joyce, but thanks for asking. Anyways, yes.
Well, I think what's interesting, less than this, the ideals, because I do think the ideals died in the 90s and seem to be being reborn for some reason with the younger generation now. Maybe because lack of that particular historical memory.
Yeah, we never saw it die.
Right.
It just wasn't.
It just
there.
Disappeared.
Yeah.
What's interesting in Leiaipi's book is the kind of, I think, palpable nostalgia for community that existed despite all of the privations. Mm-hmm. There's episodes that in there just, you know, neighbors helping each other, neighborhood feuds, nevertheless, you know, resolving in sort of charming and cute ways. A sense of, sure, ideologically inflected solidarity and a hidden repression, but also a real kind of solidarity on the very micro level, which I think gets exploded during shock therapy when,
of course,
when, you know, society is just turned upside down. And then in Albania's case, society really gets turned upside down 7 years later, where civil war just even, you know, washes liberalism away.
And these pyramid schemes, which,
yeah,
yeah. Can you actually explain that very briefly?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's detailed in the book. I'd read about it before. It's these sort of overnight, over the course of these 7 years, you just had these larger and larger corporations pop up. And I'm not going to do this justice because I'm far from expert on it, but a bunch of, you know, not even that fly-by-night corporations that had established themselves over 2 or 3 years and become brands in Albania started offering these kinds of savings schemes, which were all pyramid schemes in some level, offering incredible you know, returns on savings that people were like, you know, you're an idiot to keep cash. Why would you do this? And, you know, in a society that doesn't have a banking sector and is just sort of developing this, there's just like a complete mania over this. And it around 1997, it just implodes completely, all of it. And I forget what percentage of regular Albanian savings just evaporates overnight.
Right, which, this is what happens to our family, to EP's family.
Yeah, well, it happens to all of them. I mean, the family, you know, ends up getting, you know, torn apart even by the Civil War.
Well, that'll also do a number on your solidarity, like being taken by your neighbors and people you thought that you could trust.
No, for sure. And but the interesting thing there is, I think for Albania, it has like a very sharp ending, the liberal period. Mm-hmm. For most other countries, like I was saying, for Yugoslavia in general, we don't even have the liberal period. Our liberal period comes after a cataclysmic war. So communism ends in war. And then, you know, after war, after like, you know, the whole region, if you count it like more than a decade of fighting, but it's regionally split up, you emerge and then you have, you know, different countries with different head starts. Slovenia is already well on its way to the EU. Croatia limps in last, one of the last countries to get into the EU. And then the rest of those countries are still outside the EU and much poorer for it. And yeah. So the disillusionment there doesn't come with a hard stop, but nevertheless, there's deep cynicism, especially in the countries that are not in the EU right now. But you know, I've written about this, I think, in my previous life at the American Interest at one point, the extent to which, I mean, you've spent time in Germany, that like, you know, the Aussies, the former East Germans, their children all left to get educated, and you know, standards definitely rose. Well, maybe East Germany is not a good example because their standards really have converged because the Germans poured in so much money to actually.
But they haven't completely converged.
But then you look at something like, you know, the Czechs or the Slovaks, where the real expectation was, we're going to be just like the West. All we have to do is do X, Y, and Z, and we will be them. And they never have. No. You know, you even to this day, you will find, I mean, I even remember like my mom pointing to this stuff in sort of Croatian tabloid press that, and it might be even true what I'm about to say, that they make different kinds of products for former Eastern countries than they do for the West. So, you know, I don't know why I'm latching onto this, because no one eats peanut butter in Europe, but imagine like a crappier peanut butter, like a lower grade peanut butter that is sold in like Eastern Europe that isn't sold in France.
Because they'll never know. It sucks over there anyway.
But I've always thought that, you know, obviously all these corporations make different kinds of products for different markets and adapt it. But that lingering resentment in these countries manifests itself because someone travels over there and he's like, oh my God, no, it's Nutella. Sorry, it wasn't peanut butter. I knew it was something like that. It was Nutella that they talked about.
the peanut butter of Europe.
The peanut butter of Europe, Nutella. They were like, our Nutella is shittier than the French Nutella. They give us crappier Nutella with more like chemicals in it.
We never made it to the clean Nutella of the West, even though they told us we would.
Exactly. So the expectation is we would have the same Nutella and they're still giving us shittier Nutella. But you know what I mean? It points to this kind of resentment and disillusionment, which I do think unifies a lot of these countries. At least it's lingering to some extent, which is this like double disillusionment. You know, they lose communism and they've lost the faith in like Milton Friedman as well.
Yeah.
You know, and what are you left with, basically? Just like kind of dour Slavicness of some sort. And Germanic, Eastern Germans and all the rest of it. But yeah.
I mean, they are kind of dour as well. Yeah. Sorry, any East Germans that are listening here. But yeah, but I mean, I think that is an interesting point. Like, what are you left with? It kind of sounds like the commonality that you're describing is a general feeling of nihilism, of there being nothing you can trust. Like, neither the old nor the new was trustworthy.
Yeah.
How can you decide on anything at all? And I guess that's kind of the last question in your Monday note.
Yeah, you know, that is the last question, but it's also the question is that I didn't fully address is what I start with, which is, you know, on the level of, I mean, we can talk on societal levels, what does it mean to be so thoroughgoingly nihilistic? But I do think that from me personally, and you know me reasonably well at this point, and you and Shadi and Sam, you know, will rib me for this, like my kind of just reflexive, critical pose without actually putting out a positive vision for anything. I think that comes from that, mm-hmm. you know, in the sense that most of the ambitious narratives we have, I think, fall far short and generally, you know, don't live up to it. But that then lends one to a predisposition to just be looking for faults and not building, mm-hmm. you know?
Because of the sort of sense that it's all falling apart. It has in the past and it will.
Well, you know, it's not, I don't think it's that, like, to me anyway, it doesn't feel, maybe that's what it actually is, but it doesn't feel that, like, self-protective. It just seems to me, in my mind, as empirical, which is, you know, someone makes a claim. Let's probe it and see where it breaks, because I'm sure it'll break somewhere.
It's definitely going to.
I'll find it and then press it and then, you know, interrogate it. And, you know, so that's sort of an intellectual pose of the critic. And I didn't find it exactly. I was rereading the last chapter of Leah Ipi's book. I forget if it's in there, if it was in a different article that she wrote about, you know, that kind of intellectual personal ethics of, you know, what is, what should one's attitude be towards ideologies? I think she says something I might have put in the piece about, you know, not being cynical, that's really important, that's a personal ethic of hers. Nevertheless, she also doesn't put forward a positive vision except kind of like a vague hope for a better future. I don't know. You know, I guess what I'm getting at on the question of being a critic, I mean, I guess let me throw it back to you. Is like, you're a person of faith broadly. Are you never troubled by this, by the sort of empirical fact of, like, when you look at the world and you look at some of these claims, you're never rattled by the fact that they don't add up?
Well, I mean, of course I'm rattled. I'm rattled all the time. I think it would be hard to find any person of any faith who's being honest with you who would not admit to doubt and worry. I feel like that's also sort of like the core difficulty of faith. And the idea of faith is having faith despite that doubt. And I think Shadi actually talks about this very well. The understanding that none of this will be solved imminently, as in sort of in this lifetime, in this world. And like, so on the one hand, like, nothing's working perfectly. Like, none of these problems are like explicitly solved now. On the other hand, did we expect them to be? That's not the promise, actually. And that's not where one's hope lies. I think that is kind of the essence of, not the essence of faith, but I think that is how one with faith tends to view the world. But of course, I mean, right, but that is the balance. It is concerning. And I wonder, in a space where it's, you know, okay, put forward these different possibilities, these different theories of life, you know, negative freedom versus positive freedom. I can poke holes in either one of them. There's always a flaw. Why keep doing it? What's the point? Like, I mean, is it just a fun intellectual exercise to keep going until you die, poking the flaws into things? Or what is the drive? What would hold a society together?
No, I think what would hold a society together points to the fact that what I'm doing is anti or asocial. Yeah,
Tamir, why
toxic.
Are you destroying society?
No. I think that's sort of where I end up with that, the Monday Note essay is pointing out to that, like, that element of it, which is bad and I think needs unpacking. But I think I'm more interested on the personal level. You know, I mean, Shadi's not here, so no need to relitigate those things. But for me, you know, as you described Shadi's pose, it's good. I follow all of that. Then he leans into democracy as like the panacea. And then it just becomes, you know, an empirical fight in many ways. And at that point, his faith in democracy, this is why I end up always in these fights, pushing him into him making quite literally a metaphysical faith-based like grounding of his belief and not the sort of social science empirical one, because I don't recognize the social science empirical things, that it's purely a leap of faith to say that democracy is the good and therefore then everything follows. But it has to be grounded in this kind of almost religious thesis at the beginning of it. I respect that. I will grant and respect that, because I feel that's the one place where there's nothing for me to poke at. But as soon as you get into this sort of thing, and I mean, I throw it to you on the question of, you know, I don't think you're a communist, but you know what I mean? But on the, or maybe that's offensive. Maybe you are a communist, but you know what I mean? Like, in the sense of, I don't know, I don't think we've done it on the podcast, but, you know, even just sort of talking about, your most recent Atlantic piece is sort of talking about, you know, too much wealth and, you know, how do we do that? And you and I have talked about like this, like, idea of degrowth, which is, again, is a popular concept, which to me has a lot of troubling implications, that not least of which is maybe my lack of imagination for how it could work. It not least of which is also my feeling that, I don't know, it doesn't comport with my idea of how human beings work and how you construct your society, short of a lot of things that have been tried. And
communism.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, like, I guess I'm putting it back on you, is like, you know, the never mind the faith questions and doubt on the level of, like, you know, religion, but more about, you know, your, call them political commitments. Mm-hmm. How do you think about positive political commitments, and how does doubt and or faith play into those?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not to sidestep the question, but to step back into the shoddy area for a second. When I think about his support for democracy, in to me, what it looks like is, you know, democracy is a present solution, or what at least he believes in as, like, the best temporal solution, but not necessarily a final solution. Uh-oh. Okay. Well, okay. Well, you know what I mean.
Yes.
Yeah, that he seems to have faith that democracy is the thing that works best here. Mm. And actually, I think that in some sense, you're probably right that faith is a little bit, maybe a lot, metaphysical, in that it kind of does rely on sort of a faith-based understanding of humans as individuals who all have equal worth and need to be respected and represented, that we should all have a say because we're all valuable.
Right.
And I mean, that itself is just a, you know, a faith-based humanistic understanding. So Yeah, I think that the belief in democracy is on a certain level religious.
Yeah.
And I am much less of a democracy partisan, in fact, because I know that I hold that same belief in the worth of humans, the worth of every person. And is democracy the best way to represent that? Not sure, actually. You know, it does okay. Are there other ways of living that could respect that human value? Certainly. But, you know, we're doing democracy right now, and that's fine. But I'm not necessarily attached to that as the best or only way of preserving human dignity.
So what are these other ways, though, that these, like, anti-capitalist other ways? And like, how do you not get worried about, like, going down these roads, I guess, is my question as, you know, potentially a different generation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that you pointed out earlier is that millennials and younger maybe have less of an aversion to, you know, communism or socialism, in part because we weren't really there. Like, we did not, I guess we did perhaps live through, you know, the fall of communism, but, you know, as children, like, we weren't necessarily super involved. And so the horrors of communism or the horrors of that world falling apart are, what is the word I'm looking for here? Not ephemeral, but, like, they are imagined to us. We were not firsthand witnesses. Mm. And so it's not as immediate. It's not necessarily as scary. It's still possible to idealize, in some sense. And I think why I'm interested in concepts like limitarianism, and I don't know, I wouldn't call myself a degrowther, actually. I don't think I'm necessarily in favor of degrowth, although I do.
Explain to the listeners and me what exactly a limitarianism is. Limitarianist.
Yeah. So limitarianism, we can step back, is a philosophy coined by the Dutch philosopher Ingrid Robbins. She wrote a book about it that I wrote about for The Atlantic. And it is basically the idea that there should be limits to extreme wealth for the benefit of both the wealthy and society at large. It is not actually communism. It does not say that there will not or should never be any kind of inequality. But it's interesting to me because it basically asks one to consider or reconsider the sort of mythologies and intuitions that we tend to hold around wealth, especially as Americans.
Right.
Like this idea of deservedness, that, well, you deserve this because you alone worked really hard to make this. Mm. Or, you know, you earned this yourself. When actually, you know, we all live in a society. No one is earning anything just by themselves. And if we live in a society and, you know, profit off of that society, then society should have a say in sort of the surplus wealth created. That's sort of a short form view of limitarianism.
But I mean, is it anything more than just like a, you know, a very strict sort of redistributive cap of just, you know, above a certain amount, you're just going to get taxed at like exorbitant rates.
Yeah. So the book is actually less concerned with kind of procedure and how to do this and more about the philosophical reasons for why it could be, and in fact is, immoral to have just extreme inequality and how it's corrosive to society, to democracy, to the individual person. And, you know, she suggests like potential caps, like that, just pointing out that there is kind of, there should be a line. And if we think about it, we can all kind of identify a line between like, oh, this person's very wealthy versus this person is exorbitantly rich for absolutely no justifiable reason in a way that's bad for them and the rest of us. And the idea is that a limitarian ideal, or, you know, a cap on extreme wealth would be enforced or put into place both through institutions, like just institutions doing their job, the IRS, you know, actually closing loopholes. And yeah, also through new policies. But how that would be done is up to a society to think about what they want the caps to be and to put those in place, you know, in a corrigible and inclusive way. And so, you know, saying all of this, it's like, it's very idealistic, right? Like it is, it stands out because it feels very much like an imagined future. But I think perhaps to go back to your original question, what I find interesting about ideas like this is the ability to imagine a better future, to actually have a positive vision of what society could be, based on like the assumption that like humans do have better natures, that, you know, we can experiment in ways that perhaps we haven't perfectly in the past, that things don't always have to get worse. And I think maybe that's perhaps where if you're Demir, I think your intuition or your general position is to kind of poke holes. I think I really enjoy and find it much more hopeful and in some sense valuable, although, you know, we can see how much value we really get from that, in imagining a positive vision of the future and what that could look like. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it makes sense. I just like immediately my thoughts jump to, you know,
but
not to, but like, I mean, even the limitarian ideal that you described, I mean, it's based on some level, as you said, it's not procedural and how you'd get there, but at least in some belief in democracy, that democracies would will this if they could. Question becomes then, why don't they? And then you get into, you know, I think I don't know, I haven't read the book, but I imagine you get into questions about false consciousness and the inability of the true society to express its will, because otherwise, why wouldn't we already be doing this?
I mean, well, it depends on what you mean by false consciousness. I think there is definitely an element of false consciousness that's present in especially the United States is an American's view of wealth and their, you know, potential to become wealthy themselves one day. I think it was Steinbeck who, you know, says that all Americans feel themselves to just be temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
Right.
Like, oh, why would you tax the wealthy? Like, I might be a billionaire someday too.
Right.
Not realizing that, like, you probably won't be actually. And voting in favor of these, you know, policies that preserve extreme wealth at the very top is, in fact, voting against your best interest. It just is. But is that false consciousness? I mean, that it is objectively true.
I mean, but... You know what I mean? It gets at. I mean, if you just want to unpack it in a like purely philosophical way, not worry about how you'd get from A to B, it gets at the question of, you know, that pesky one of like, you know, what's the matter with Kansas? Why aren't people voting their interests? Why aren't people, you know, interest maximizers in the way that a philosopher in the Netherlands would like them to be? And the question then ends up being, again, are there, you know, I guess it sets up this thing. There's the philosopher identifies the good and the just. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, empirically determined individuals don't seem to vote in accordance with the good and just vision. That disjunct is then ascribed to something why this is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brainwashing or
political capture.
For one thing,
do the wealthy have outsized influence on legislation? Like, is there sort of a wealth protection industry in place that is more powerful than the vote of the average person? Yes. And I mean, it's interesting. This is something that's also, we're kind of beginning to see this in polling right now too, and in policies that are being put forth. If you ask the average American, and especially younger Americans, most people are willing to say that inequality has gotten out of hand in the United States. But for some reason that has not translated itself into actual policy change yet. Although there are policies that have been proposed that are on the table. I mean, first Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren appeared, and there was actually a lot of excitement behind them. Even now, Joe Biden has proposed a billionaire tax that actually some people are quite excited about. Will it come to fruition? We don't know. But yeah, what are the reasons for that? It's not necessarily because people don't agree or don't have sort of a positive vision of the future that imagines a more equal society.
So obviously we'll put your essay in the show notes, but walk me through some of the social ills of having a small set of hyper wealthy, because we're not talking about merely the very wealthy. We're talking about that hyper wealthy set, right?
Sure. The super rich.
So
yeah.
You've said, you know, even I think there's some sleight of hand there that we as a society will decide. I mean, who is we? What is society? And how is the decision made? But okay.
Like, of course.
But let's leave all of that aside. But, you know, what exactly is the toxicity and the mismatch according to this philosophy? In the sense that, is there a belief that merely the redistribution of that call it excess wealth would lead to better social outcomes that are measurably better? Or is it just that they mustn't be that well off compared? That leads to some kind of, I'm not sure what, envy, yeah, lack of social trust? What's the ill exactly?
Yeah, so it's kind of both. I mean, she discusses kind of moral ills and then also social ills. So, I mean, obviously just, you know, if some people are incredibly super rich, they have outsized influence on, you know, politics and society. So it's kind of impossible to have a real democracy when some people's votes and influence counts so much more than others. So if you care about equal representation, that is a problem. You can think about how extreme wealth is garnered, and in many cases, how it can rely on exploitation or other moral ills. Not always, but often. And then, you know, there's the question of what extreme inequality does to people, to humans. So there's a lot of research that shows that wealth over a certain point begins to lose its marginal utility. Like, once you become a certain amount of wealthy, it's not like you can spend it all. You know, you're not actually doing anything with it.
Well, the argument against it, though, right, is just like that, you know, at minimum, a self-interested capitalist will allocate it more efficiently than the state would. That's the basic argument. Now, again, what's efficient?
Where does that argument come from, actually? Like, who?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you can trace it back to, in general, the insight of the end of history, which is that the more you arrogate, like, competency for redistribution and like central planning to the state, the less efficient it is, to the point where in a geopolitical competition, the unrestrained capitalist society will crush the other one. So at the limit, you know, that's where it comes from, I think. Now, again,
so
I think
the Friedman-esque like idea that just the invisible hand is just going to be more accurate in the end, that markets just provide that much more accurate information.
I mean, I think I've even talked about it on the podcast. I think the thing that I find fascinating about the United States, and now having lived through it, I mean, it was like you could sort of see it empirically before, but now just like sort of paying attention to it. After 2008 and then after COVID, the extent to which overall this country bounces back quicker than Europe is fascinating. Like, and mm-hmm. if you look at levels of, you know, just individual prosperity since 2008. And now you're talking about like taking Europe as an aggregate and the United States as, you know, a parallel aggregate. You're talking about phenomenally wealthy societies. So in general, you know, you're not talking about serious privation. But on the level of individuals, you're seeing we're way more prosperous than the Europeans are since 2008. Like it's like this. And part of that has to do with the fact that no one's in charge here. We are cruel to our workers. So we have like...
So some people are more prosperous.
No. But in general, it's like the society rejiggers itself faster mm-hmm. is what it comes down to. Now, again, I mean, it's call it a choice, if you will, between, you know, a less agile society that has perhaps more safety nets and arguably more some kind of like solidarity than this society does. I would still put to you that, you know, in a measurable time frame, the cruel America will eat your lunch over and over again. And I don't think that the Europeans are on a really good path right now. It's going to get worse for them. I think in our lifetime, when we're in a retirement home, Christine, we'll look at the Europeans and we're going to be like,
poor Europe,
poor people. Where, you know, we're not going to be Elon Musk or anything, you and I. Well, maybe you will, but
I
like,
will
but,
not.
I think comparatively, the two societies, I think you'll be able to see that. Now, again, yeah, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. And maybe that's not the case. It's my intuition.
So I think one of the interesting things too in this question is how one measures prosperity and prosperousness. And I think one of the interesting moral arguments that Robbins makes in her book, Limitarianism, is about sort of the moral corrosion that comes with extreme inequality and extreme wealth and extreme separation, I guess, between classes. And that is manifested in, like, yes, a lack of solidarity. The wealthy, and especially the extremely wealthy, draw away from the rest of society. The idea that wealth is how you measure, that, you know, monetary value is how you measure good, how you measure prosperity, how you measure one's worth, means that there is always this pressure to be doing more, to get more, to earn more, to keep up, that inculcates envy, and actually inculcates societal disaffection, which is why in societies with extremely high inequality, like, things kind of begin to fall apart and people start to go after each other, which is sort of what we're seeing right now. And I mean, like, this is always the, you know, like, oh, well, like, Americans have, you know, so many more televisions and like huge, enormous vehicles. And like, how could you say that this is not better? But there are also other things that one might value, whether it's a sense of peace of mind, a sense that, you know, you don't have to be rapaciously at your neighbor's throat, the sense that, like, you don't have to be on a hamster wheel to keep up with the Joneses because that's the only way that you measure your worth. Is it possible that limiting extreme wealth, like, and, you know, not to say that there aren't inequalities that would always be present, like, some people just work really hard and make a lot of money. But making the ideal something other than just accumulating the most money possible, could be morally and psychologically beneficial for a country?
I suppose. I mean, again, like, I mean, I it's sort of the argument for,
I mean, like, we talk Denmark, about, right, like, America, it's so rich, and also, like, half of America seems to be dying deaths of despair. So how's that going? Clearly all the excess wealth isn't fixing that problem. So maybe that can't be the entirety of the solution, just finding ways for people to keep making themselves richer. Like, perhaps there are other human values that are worth focusing on, and actually moral ills worth paying attention to that won't just be solved by more money or more growth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the same time, right, is that the social safety net around Europe, there's all sorts of trade-offs that they have been able to make that, you know, again, feeds into this vision of, like, a less cruel world. One being that, you know, Europe has been a kind of paradise since 1945, protected by the United States, or Western Europe was, in any case.
Largesse, yeah.
So as a result, even still, even without having to spend at America's exorbitant rates on defense, social safety nets are creaking across the continent. And, you know, if the United States does end up abandoning Europe, as it may in the coming decades, on these sorts of things, they're going to have to be making some really hard choices.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard choices about these values that I think one can comfortably talk about in the abstract, but, like, there are trade-offs that need to happen, you know, about them. I was talking to a friend about this, a European who was in town recently, and I, you know, he's Frenchman, and I was sort of asking him, like, about the, how he sees Europe at this very moment. And I guess he's somewhat of, like, a right-wing thinker, like, but he said, you know, the thing that really jumped out at me, he said, the big economic bet that Europe made really comported very closely with a lot of the values that you talk about, but it was also tied to green investments. That's how Europe was going to get out of this. They're going to spend to build up the green economy. Mm-hmm. There's virtue in that. New jobs would happen, investment in high tech, and all the rest of that. Turns out, he said, yeah, not my sector, but he said that so many of those bets, there's a race to the bottom against China.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the inputs for a lot of these technologies, China has bottlenecks on them, from raw earth, you know, rare earth materials, which Europe is poor in. Europe's always been, like, poor in a lot of that. You know, this idea that, like, Europe could just, through, I guess, an educated workforce, just magically get itself to this place and not have to compete,
mm-hmm,
in the international system against other societies that don't share these values about equity. A communist society that doesn't share exactly the same values on equity and individual social dignity. Human dignity, not social dignity, individual human dignity. No, I mean, the Chinese communists talk a good game about not letting people fall through the cracks, even though they have wild economic inequalities as well in their society.
Right, you can certainly poke holes in that.
But you know what I'm saying is that ramble there was about, yeah, we can talk about ideals and values, but
if one society is not playing by the same rules, then there's always going to be.
I feel like there's always the veto of competition of some sort.
Of the person who's not playing fair, yeah, or right. The person, yeah.
And overall, it all exists in a kind of dog eat dog world. Even if you can build up walls temporarily within something and say, no, 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 we don't play by those rules as the Europeans have for a very long time. No, 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 no. We are the future of the world. This is how the world will be. Turns out it's not the case. At least doesn't at this point in 2024 appear to be the case that like the EU is the model for you know, the future organization of the world. Doesn't look like it's going that way. So, you know,
I think
that's, so this is me poking holes again.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
No, like, and I think that's a fair critique. I mean, I will also, this is, I guess this is not a response, but also just another thing that comes up, I think, is this idea that, well, wealth is the great motivator and, you know, having wealth is what allows people to explore new avenues to diversify their economies, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the questions in the book Limitarianism and this idea is also like, is that truly all that motivates us? I mean, one of the United States' most productive periods was one in which we had sort of the highest wealth taxes, which was the post-war period. And obviously we were propped up by the fact that everyone else was kind of flopping. Yes. But it's also entirely possible for even the most wealthy, even the most inventive, talented people to feel like they have a responsibility to give back to their societies, to have a shared vision of growth and to still come up with good things and make them work. And perhaps there's an idea that actually by there being less inequality, we would be in some ways drawn together and more drawn to those sorts of sort of shared communal good ideas. So that is a thing. But yeah, I mean, I think there's always the factor that they're just like, is someone else. There's someone who is not playing by the same rules as you. I think this gets back to sort of the imminent versus larger framework here. Like you kind of, you're like, well, in a couple of, you know, a couple of decades, we'll see that Europe is falling apart, et cetera. Like, is that the end? Like, is that just will that be the end of history? Or is it possible that something else could happen?
That's it for part one, dear listeners. There's a lot more where that came from. If you're not yet a paying subscriber, please head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and become one. Help support our work. Hope to see you in the bonus.